Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. My name is Aidan Beattie. I'm one of the co-hosts of this channel. Today we're talking to Marion Casey, a professor at Glucksman Ireland House at New York University, where she also serves as director of undergraduate studies. Professor Casey has published widely on various aspects of Irish-American history, and in 2006 she co-edited Making the Irish-American History and Heritage of the Irish in the United States with Joe Lee. Her most recent book is The Green Space, The Transformation of the Irish Image, which has just been recently published with NYU Press's Irish Diaspora series, a series that we've featured a lot of books of in this channel. Professor Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Aidan.
So maybe we could start at the very end of your book, or at the end of the book's narrative, after a couple of centuries of pretty large-scale Irish migration to America. What is the Irish image today in contemporary America? Is it Joe Biden? Is it Irish bars? Is it just awful New Agey Celtic mysticism? Are there even any dominant images anymore?
Well, in many respects, it's who you ask and the perspective from which you view Irish. So people in Ireland will have a different definition of what Irish is. I always ask my students at the beginning of every semester, you know, do a word association. And generally what comes back is green and Guinness, St. Patrick's Day, to a lesser extent, Notre Dame, and Fighting Irish. And sometimes music, sometimes family. It really, really depends on how close the student or the person is to the immigrant from Ireland. And the further you are removed, the late generation ethnicity changes sort of the understanding of that word and is far more influenced by American popular culture than.
So there's a lot of things you mentioned there that we might go back to later on about commodities like Guinness and migration and so on. But maybe we go back to the what seems to me to be the original image of the Irish in America, although I'm very much looking at this as a person who studies Ireland rather than Irish America. Is it too simplistic to just say that the single original image of the Irish in America is of an off-white, racially inferior famine migrant? Were there these kind of multiple images even in the 1840s, or just one dominant image back then?
No, there's not one dominant image. And it's actually fascinating because so much of the historiography is, to use your phrase, off-white, racially inferior famine migrants. And that's middle of the 19th century. And in fact, we have an earlier image that is circulating in America that is derived from Thomas Moore and Moore's Melodies that are extremely pervasive in a certain segment of American society. So a high art form, concert halls, families that have pianos in the parlor. So it's sort of a upper class, educated, arts oriented segment of American society would have been familiar with Thomas Moore's images of Ireland, which is Ireland as Erin, a female persona. It's a sentimental and nostalgic image. It's very benign in many ways. It's not entire at all like the negative images that come out of nativism in the middle of the century.
And then how does the actual arrival then of the famine Irish in the 1840s complicate this, or how does it change that benign image?
Well, they exist in different rhetorical realms. So the demonization of the famine migrants is happening in newspapers, for example, not on the sheet music and on the piano in the parlor. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's and not those who are playing Moore's Melodies are not necessarily engaging with famine migrants. They are slowly employing Irish domestic servants in their houses, that's a different thing. So again, once you have an Irish immigrant in your home, it's a more intimate setting, and then it's harder to demonize that person. So there's, to answer your question, Aidan, it's there are at least two competing images in the early 19th century that one is benign and one is really negative.
And then as you get, let's say, a greater assimilation by the famine Irish or just Irish migrants in general, towards the end of the 19th century and into the start of the 20th century, do those two images change? What new images emerge?
Yeah, a very important milestone, I would say, would be the an awareness around the 1860s, an awareness of the Irish as more than inferior famine immigrants. So, for example, the Irish have been parading in honor of St. Patrick's Day, but they're sort of under the radar. There are news items about them, but it's, you know, 100 people, 200 people. But it really begins to take off in the 1860s. And in arguably Dean Boucicault's 1864 runaway smash hit, Erin Ab Hoag, which incorporates the song, an older song, he revives it, The Wearing of the Green. Those two things focus attention on the parade as a spectacle on city streets, and also an opportunity to commercialize, if you will. Yeah. And it's the same, at the same time, you have the commercialization of Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving. So the calendar is commercializing, and March conveniently comes with a march, literally a march, and a shamrock, a symbol that can be, and green. Yeah.
So could you maybe tell us a little bit more about this history of St. Patrick's Day in the United States, where it often seems to be a bigger event than it actually is back home in Ireland? Where does that go after the 1860s? How does that develop as a commercialized calendar event?
There are no limits to where it can go anymore. It has just exploded. And I think it was helped along in great measure by, you know, it starts out small. You buy a green ribbon to wear in your hair, or even on the horse's harness, you put a green ribbon. Then it becomes items for sale, souvenir items for sale on the street. Green snakes, for example, because St. Patrick and the snakes. Then those sort of, what'll we call them? Those sort of, I don't want to call them souvenirs. What'll we call them?
Commodified items?
That's too rarefied, I guess. Let's say, for the average person, it's sort of a memento of the day, mementos of the day. They're innocuous at first, but the more people see the profit that can be made, the more inventive they become. So by the 1920s, there's pages of catalogs in which you can buy everything, papier-mâché pigs and green hats, et cetera, et cetera. And those items are then used by teachers in American classrooms to teach about the Irish. And it's a very embroidered history, or an embroidered account of St. Patrick. And also, everything gets so jumbled by the 1930s that everything that related to St. Patrick's Day becomes equated with Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Did you say papier-mâché pigs?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that seems odd and maybe even slightly anti-Irish to kind of focus in on pigs and swinishness and things like that.
Well, the first-generation Irish immigrants from Ireland were outraged by the association of the Irish with the pig in American popular culture. The pig appears on St. Patrick's Day postcards, in the souvenirs that we just mentioned, and there is pushback against that. There are people who say, no, you know, we appreciate the role of the pig in the Irish agricultural economy, but it is not a symbol of the saint or our people. But in the greeting card business or the postcard business, which the postcards were generally made in color in Germany. And in Germany, the pig was associated with luck. And somehow this concept of the Irish as lucky, which is interesting, they had been unlucky in the middle of the 19th century. By the 1920s, they're a lucky people, and the pig is attached to them. And the four-leaf clover as well, for luck. Whereas the shamrock is the genuine article.
Yeah. So as all of this is happening, then, I mean, there's a sort of a version of Irishness that is, at least from an Irish perspective, it seems detached from Ireland itself, right? It's as you say, it's being produced in Germany, but then sold in the US. It's four-leaf clovers, not shamrocks, which the shamrock being a kind of a Catholic thing to explain the Trinity rather than just a lucky charm. How much do events in Ireland continue to play a role in this? So let's say in the 1920s, when you have major political violence in Ireland, does that play a role in changing the image of the Irish in America?
And I've thought about this a lot, and I think that it's quite an unfortunate set of historical circumstances. So Ireland is massively distracted from 1914 to, we'll say, 1938. They're massively distracted by what's happening on the ground in Ireland. And that opened a vacuum in America. Nobody's paying attention to what's happening in America except the first, you know, the 1920s immigrants are trying to push back against it. But there is a small, their numbers are declining because of legislation that comes in there, immigration legislation. Their numbers are declining, and there's only so many fronts on which they can push back. And so it's sort of, once the Catholic Church says it's okay to put on the St. Patrick's Day plays in children's classrooms, or, you know, tack up big green shamrocks on the wall, or, you know, clay pipe motifs, et cetera. Once the church weighs in on that, the game is lost, basically. The game is lost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then so, Ireland has to come later on, mid-century, Ireland has to, for the first time, really deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
They're encountering two separate histories have happened.
Sure. So does it matter at all then, let's say that by mid-century also then Ireland is neutral during World War II? So tell us a little bit about that. How do Irish Americans, or just Americans in general, deal with that?
Well, the American media, and by that I mean newspapers, magazines, and radio in this early part of the 20th century, they are actually quite interested in what's happening in Ireland. They're interested in nation building. They are fascinated by De Valera. They increasingly wonder, is he going to be another Mussolini? Then we get so a lot of it is negative because it's very much influenced by British journalism and British rhetoric on the Irish. And neutrality just is the mid-century chapter of that. It's the maligning of neutral Ireland. It doesn't come out of a vacuum. There had been negative images of Irish politics and politicians and the ability to be a self-governing nation. That was all over the media for neutrality. Neutrality doesn't help, but they do pretty well. You know, once the Marshall Plan comes in, the images and tourism that helps rehabilitate the image, the political image.
So if there is this rehabilitated political image, and we maybe jump another two decades ahead, we get a moment where you could imagine very pro-British Americans are quite horrified by Ireland during the Troubles, and yet that doesn't seem to be the case, unless I'm mistaken.
That period in the Troubles is complicated, and again, it's misunderstood by the media. It's conflated into a sectarian conflict. Despite the fact that there are Irish American groups advocating for civil rights in Northern Ireland, it's conflated to sectarianism, and that plays into the British perspective. You know, mm-hmm. And again, it's, you know, where are Americans, what is the source of Americans' news on Ireland at any given time in the 20th century? It's much healthier now than it was in the 1960s and earlier. The source was generally American correspondents who were based in London, socializing with the British press corps and getting their news that way. There's no one really on the ground in Northern Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this is all obviously like very serious, maybe in some ways very grim. I want to switch quite a bit to something that can seem a lot less serious, but I think has a lot more seriousness kind of hidden underneath it. And that's this kind of commodified Irishness that you're really concerned with throughout your book. But I want to talk particularly about one of the oddest things in the book, but also one of the most fascinating and wonderful things, which is this a thatched cottage butter dish that you have a photo of. Can you tell me, where did you find that? What is that? Where did it come from?
My grandmother, who I don't remember, she brought it to the United States to my mother as a gift in 1965. And she was a small farmer, a widow, and this is a luxury item. So it's an interesting, she probably bought it at Shannon Airport. And of course it's so delicate. You cannot use this as a butter dish. So, it has always resided in my mother's china cabinet. And, when I was thinking about illustrations for the book, the cottage is a theme running through it. The cottage is an image of this, you know, if you weigh it against the negative media attention on the political front, the cottage is a very, appealing, non-threatening image of Ireland, you know? And Bleak has a very long history in the United States. For listeners who may not be familiar with it, Bleak is a small village in County Fermanagh. And Bleak was, it's a 19th century pottery that continues to exist today. And it was exporting its products to the United States from the 19th century. It was always equated with quality. It's not a cheap product. So it's who bought it in the United States is people who could afford it. That 100 years later, my grandmother, the farmer's widow, is buying it for her immigrant daughter who has moved to the United States. The purchase of it by my grandmother is part of a Buy Irish campaign to support the Irish economy, rather than buying English products, buy Irish products. But in the United States, Bleak meant quality and had a good run until it was imitated. So Lennox, for example, an American china, made Lennox Bleak. And there were Bleak went to court multiple times to try to stop infringement of their trademark.
So even to think about sort of the politics of this, you have a Northern Irish based company producing products for an American audience to kind of with this incredibly nostalgic image of old Ireland. How much does tourism then become part of this? Another way to experience a very safe, romantic image of a commodified Irishness.
Can I say one more thing on Bleak, Aidan?
Please, yeah.
And then
sure.
Come back to your question. When the border is established, Bleak is not affected. It's still seen as Irish, not as Northern Irish, because it existed before the border. And it had also trademarked its products with what's called, it's a mark, an Irish trademark, a specific thing from around 1906. So every piece of Bleak on the bottom has the potter's mark and an Irish trademark. So it was seen as Irish, as not in non-political sense. So in that, yeah. So even in the 1960s, it was seen as Irish, not Northern Irish. Okay. So sure. Remind me of your question again.
So we have this like very carefully constructed image of Ireland that Bleak itself is invested in. And how much does tourism become a way to continue that or to sell that in a different medium?
Well, I suppose we have to step back a little bit to think about the way in which Americans in general were familiarized with a material concept of Irish. Lace, for example, wool. These were high-end exports from Ireland. So there's an association. So when tourism happens, part of what gets sold in places like tourist shops or Shannon Airport are things that Americans expect to find. They've already associated themselves with certain things like Balik. Tourism is interesting. It's connected to publishing and a form of entertainment called the Hibernicon. So you could virtually experience Ireland on this side of the ocean. Leisure tourism to Ireland is concentrated in people who can afford it. And for a long time, it's not the average American who can afford it until we get 2 weeks paid vacation and a reduced airfare and ocean liner fares. So it's not massive. So in that period, when it's sort of marketed, when Ireland is marketing itself to Americans going on the grand tour of Europe, right? And you stop off in Ireland, there's a certain route that is established. You go from Cove to Blarney, and maybe if you have time, you'll go to Killarney, and then you get back on your ship and you go on to the continent or to England. So that's kind of sets the pathways for tourism. And then it really takes off. Part of Ireland's requirements under the Marshall Plan was to develop its tourism infrastructure. And so the 1950s are really critical for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And then as this is happening, what are some of the other media in which you could see an image of Ireland being propagated in movies, in news, print media? Where else do you see this?
Today?
No, I think in the 1950s, yeah.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. In general, for example, the penny postcards of circa 1910, some of them were really derogatory. Some of them pulled from old hackneyed vaudeville jokes. And there was a pushback. The Ancient Order of Hibernians in 1911 undertook a campaign to eradicate those postcards, right? So what happens then, it jumps media. So greeting cards come out. They're in an envelope, so the Postal Service can't see them. So that jump. You can still find these negative images all over the web if you look in the right places. So it never goes away. It just jumps media. So it's everywhere.
And then how much do movies play a part in this? Because I know you talk about that a little bit.
I originally had a separate chapter just on movies, but the book was getting too long. So I folded it into the St. Patrick's Day chapter to talk about how early movies used an exploitation campaign to promote their films, which included all the St. Patrick's Day memorabilia that we were talking about earlier. So they would do up their lobbies with shamrocks or green merchandise to promote a film that maybe only had Irish in the title or maybe had one Irish cop in it. It was a way of bringing in audiences. So, you know, today you can find, really St. Patrick's Day is where you see it more consciously. And I would just say the other, where you do see it also, it is St. Patrick's Day, but it's, the Irish government has, since 1953, had a standing invitation to the White House. So you always see the Taoiseach or the ambassador to the United States wearing a green tie, presenting a bowl of shamrocks. That is a very positive image. And no other country has that standing thing. Aer Lingus. Aer Lingus also has been careful to curate its image. It never got rid of the shamrock on its tail. It has adapted it. Modernized it. The cabin crew still wear Irish designed and made clothing. You encounter an Irish image when you step on board that plane, right? Which is entirely different to what you see in most American St. Patrick's Day parades. you know, it's night and day. So there's still, well, Ireland is tending to maybe not so much since COVID, but the St. Patrick's Festival is far more American than what Aer Lingus is doing, for example, mm-hmm. Dublin St. Patrick's Festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe just as a final question, one of my favorite things in the whole book is this advertisement that you reproduce of a World War II era Coca-Cola advert about Ireland. Can you just tell us about that and its background and so on?
It's so interesting. It's a it says, "Have a Coke." How the Irish? How does it go? Hold on, I forget now. Let me just look at it here for a second.
If you want to start the whole answer again, then once
yeah, sorry. Yeah. Okay,
sure.
Yeah, of course. Oh yeah, that ad is really interesting. Its headline is "Have a Coke equals Cade Mila Falcha, 100,000 welcomes." .. or how Americans make friends in Ireland. There is so much to unpack. This is a rural scene, a cottage, a horse and cart, a young girl holding a lamb, an older man holding a bottle of Coke, and three American soldiers also beckoning to the young girl. It's a 1943 ad, and it's the timing is really interesting because we do have American troops in Northern Ireland at this time, because Northern Ireland was part of Britain and was not neutral. But the iconography and the rhetoric of hospitality is something that becomes crucial to tourism later on. It's just so interesting.
Well, that's a good place to end, maybe. Obviously, as everything you've been saying has been suggesting, this is a book with a lot of contemporary resonances in terms of how Ireland continues to be marketed and sold in very curated and careful ways. Professor Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Aidan, very much. Thank you.